Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on this Monday edition of Trumpet Radio Live, millions have been displaced globally in 2016. There's a new report out on that. American cities also are running out of room. Apparently, it's hard to find a house these days. President Trump visits the Middle East, his first international trip. Lots to talk about there. And there are new colors, if you can believe it. They're coming from algorithms. They've invented some new ones. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. You can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm and email us comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today on this Monday. Getting started again after a weekend, a fairly nice weekend. We had a fair bit of rain through Friday night. I took a stroll through one of the local parks, and I was surprised by how much standing water there still was. So I don't know how much we got. I didn't really look, but there's still a lot around. And because of that, there's more spiders, too. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but more spiders this year.
Oh, I vanquished quite a few just last night. I was mowing my yard yesterday, and I was weed whacking parts of it, and this started to sink. My backyard's weird. It's like a cliff. So one part's high, one part's low. So just water collects there. But anyway, I was just standing there and I was moving. I'm like, what's going on? And I was just sinking in the ground.
It's too saturated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. We have gotten a lot. We have we were actually in our backyard yesterday. Also, different backyard. But and there's this hole in the ground, just a small one, something burrowed in there. And my wife, the Hawkeye, she's, look at that. And there's a spider in there, a big spider, living in the hole. So I Googled it, and I'm not sure if it's a tarantula or what, but something that's burrowing in the ground. I tried to poke him with a stick, and he went down the hole, so he's still there. anyway, when I was looking at that, that's when they said, hey, because of all the rain we've had this year, you can expect more critters.
Yeah, I feel like I've even gotten a couple spider bites just in the house. Like last night I woke up and I had a large lump on the right side of my face. But then I went back to sleep and overnight the lump just completely disappeared. But I feel like I got bit by something.
The people that don't like spiders, which is probably most, right? I think the statistics are that we are surrounded by them all the time. Like they're always within a close proximity. We just don't know it. So, and there is evidence that we probably have them around us at night more than we realize, too, crawling across our faces and stuff. So, and nobody wants to think about that, but it is something that can happen. So if you're in an area like Oklahoma, we have a lot of listeners online in different areas, you might be dealing with something similar. A lot of listeners in Australia, they deal with a lot of crazy animals. Most of the deadly animals live in Australia, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Huge spiders, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about this, but that one huntsman spider was dragging a dead mouse up the fridge.
Wow.
Like it had enough strength to carry the mouse up a vertical plane and then drag it to wherever its lair was.
Yeah.
And the guy was just videotaping it laughing.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
In his house?
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. I don't know what I'd do. I probably wouldn't laugh. I'd probably, I don't know.
Either the house, for me, either the house would be on fire or I'd get a new fridge or something would happen.
You'd have to do something to get that out of there. There's a new report that came out from the statistics from last year, from 2016, and they say that more than 31 million people were internally displaced. Natural disasters were the largest source of displacement. After that, violence and conflict together resulted in nearly 7 million new cases of people being displaced at a rate of about 15,000 per day. And, you know, that's the numbers kind of get so big you don't think maybe as much about it. But those are individuals, 15,000 individuals. You know, we see that here in the States where a tornado will come through, blow a house down, and then that family doesn't have a place to be. But there's somebody there to usually help, the Red Cross, or they have family or something, and they can get back on their feet. In some of these cases, they don't have anybody to help. Like we talked about a while ago, Grant, I think you had the story about that road where all those people were just living in, it was over in Africa somewhere.
Yeah, Niger maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
To where they're just living on the side of this big road, this abandoned road, because they have no place to go. So that's happening to quite a few people. 15,000 per day are being displaced because of conflicts. This includes some 922,000 cases in the Democratic Republic of Congo, 824,000 in Syria, which we would expect, I guess, and 659,000 in Iraq. The global population of such displacements has been on the rise since 2003 and now exceeds 40 million altogether since that time. You know, if you think about Iraq, the conflict there blew up in what, like 2002, 2003, something like that?
I think it was 2004 is when the big fighting started.
So you think about that. If you were born right around that time in Iraq, you know, today you'd be 13. And your whole life has been a series of war, displacement, death. You think about a 13-year-old growing up in the U.S., if he's had he or she has had a good upbringing, which hopefully they have, they've had, you know, school and activities and sports and different common things. What's life like in Iraq for somebody like that?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine over here, you know, gunshots being heard from a couple of blocks away and maybe a car driving down the street and then just exploding because of a landmine. Maybe the shooting takes place in some of the big cities occasionally, but for the most part, none of us could even relate to that kind of life, and then being forced to move probably a dozen or more times just to escape some of the hot spots.
Yeah, we think about in this country, in many cases, we think about the future, and you know, I hope to go to this school, or I hope to have this career and have a family, or whatever the personal goals are. And there, it'd be just about day-to-day survival, I would think. You would have to become very jaded emotionally because of probably all the hardships.
Yeah, well, during the Iraq War, when the Sunni and Shiites were warring against each other, basically Al-Qaeda for the Sunnis and then Jesh al-Mahdi for the Shiites, they were funded by Iran. They were fighting each other inside the country, and that displaced about 2 million people during the Iraq War. And during that time, children, their parents would disappear. You'd find them, their bodies on the side of the road. Both sides would just throw the bodies somewhere in the city, wherever it was. And that continues to this day with ISIS. And they just found a new place, I think it's in Syria or Iraq, where ISIS was conducting chemical experiments on people. And so there's lots of cases where, especially after the Americans left, because the American soldiers did protect the population from these sorts of people. But when America left, all of a sudden, if a child was going to school or playing outside, he'd come home and his parents are gone.
Yeah.
And he never sees them again. Or they miraculously appear after a couple more years with bunch of scars on their bodies. And that's just in Iraq. And then Syria is kind of the same thing. Then the UN dispatch just released a new video last week on violence going on in the Central African Republic. And it's the same thing. You have young teenagers, their parents are getting killed. It's a war between Christians and Muslims. They get so mad, they get machetes. They tell like the cameraman, "Oh, I'm gonna go kill a Muslim." They try to UN peacekeepers shoot them, and then these teenagers are growing up to kill, to murder, and they're probably gonna be killed in the process of it eventually. Families are running away, living in the bush, like in the mountains, in the forest, just to get away from the violence. So these are the lives of people, and most young people who grew up in them don't live very long because they take justice into their own hands and they just become another victim of the many conflicts going on in the world.
Right. When you were mentioning that, that's what I was thinking, that you would get probably very vengeful and you'd want to pay back whoever hurt you. And it's just a cycle that continues. And well, that's what nations are, what, families that have just gotten really big in most cases. And the wars are, you know, personal problems that expand and expand and expand. And so you have these terrible situations. As far as displacement goes, natural disasters, though, led the way. The most displacements, 24.2 million people, internal displacements in 2016. That's amazing. You know, if you had asked me before seeing this report, what has displaced more people, violence or natural disasters, I would have thought violence. But it's natural disasters at this point. More than 7.4 million in China, 5.9 million in the Philippines, and 2.4 million in India. In countries like Nigeria, South Sudan, and Somalia, the combined effects of disaster and violent conflict are fueling rapid displacement and extreme food shortages. So those people are in a really tough spot there. But yeah, I mean, you think about, I guess, those huge storms or earthquakes or something come through, and then you hear about a lot of people dying, but it's on the other side of the world, in China or somewhere. But that's a huge number, 24.2 million in 2016 displaced from natural disasters.
Yeah, that's about two-thirds the population of Canada having to move someplace else, either internally or to try to get to different countries. And some of it, I mean, most of it is from natural disasters. Things, some things are caused from mankind and conflict and poor agricultural practices and all that. Some of it's just the weather, typhoons and earthquakes, that kind of thing. So yeah, these problems always persist in some manner or the other, but it does show that man isn't helping things, and we're causing probably, I would say mankind's caused most of it, even though some of the natural disasters, you can't help those.
Well, but again, sometimes they build up in bad spots. The construction's shoddy, to say the least, because of poverty, maybe. And so you have disasters in some parts of the world that are just so much more catastrophic because you have so many more people living in a danger zone and then living in dangerous conditions, too, to where, you know, that could happen in the U.S. as well. But in most cases, there are storm shelters. You have warning systems. Even here in Oklahoma, we deal with that every year. Tornadoes come through, and if you had no one to warn you, that we'd have and we were all crammed together, we'd have a lot more fatalities. But they give you plenty of warning, and in most cases can get someplace safe.
Right. Well, think about a place like Haiti, where they've basically their whole country's been wiped out more than once. And obviously, if something similar happened in America, it would still be bad. But it would be hard to imagine entire towns caving in on themselves, because maybe the architecture would be a little bit more stable. I mean, even in California, where we've had some pretty big problems, it seems like the recovery is a lot faster and the damage is bad, yet it is still possible to come back from.
Yeah. There's a related note to that. We haven't maybe talked about the Mediterranean as much recently and the refugees going across there, but that's still going on. 5,000 refugees pulled from the Mediterranean in just 2 days. Italian and Libyan Coast Guard crews saved the refugees who were sailing from Libya to Italy between May 18th and the 20th. So that was just a few days ago. Pulled 5,000 out of there. And so they keep going across, trying to get to Europe, I guess, get away from the conflicts there. They just keep coming and coming. And so it's easy to kind of think those problems are a thing of the past because they're not getting the top coverage anymore. It's hard to get much of that in when you got to talk about U.S.-Russia collusion 23 and a half hours out of the day, or the thought that maybe that happened. But there are some real issues going on here with, say, the refugee crisis and things like that. Those problems don't go away just because you don't report on them.
That does highlight a pretty big problem in the media, doesn't it? The fact that we focus on a private meeting where everyone who is in the room said that there was no wrongdoing, instead of looking at the fact that thousands or even millions of people are being affected by these huge problems every day. We should probably look at trying to solve some of those issues instead of looking into what is really amounting to a conspiracy to try to oust the president.
Yeah, there is a lot happening, and it's not all getting reported on, but put in a little plug for thetrumpet.com. Check that out. The most relevant stories there and some good write-ups and analysis about that, because there are a lot of issues globally going on that it'd be good to pay attention to. Back here in the United States, sometimes people sue and they win. A woman awarded $100,000 for Starbucks coffee burns. This happened at McDonald's, you know, years ago, the famous coffee burn. Now Starbucks got burnt. Actually, they burned somebody, and then they got burnt. The lady got $100,000. I think the McDonald's case was a lot more money than that, but this is $100,000. Starbucks has been ordered to pay a Florida woman $100,000 after she suffered first and second degree burns from their coffee, her lawyers announced. Gleefully, I imagine. 43-year-old lady endured permanent scarring from, or sorry, after the lid on a venti-sized Pike Place coffee popped off at a Jacksonville drive-thru window in 2014. The slip led to the scalding 190-degree beverage pouring on her lap. The lid was either not attached properly or was defective. So, yeah, interesting situation. I've gotten hot drinks from a lot of places, and I've thought, well, this is too hot. But I've just been careful with it and been okay, thankfully.
Yeah, at least this is not a case of someone drinking a hot beverage and somehow knowing that it would not knowing that it would be hot. And that McDonald's case you mentioned, I think they paid millions to that person. Who was really just not being too careful. At least here it does seem like a genuine mistake on the part of Starbucks with a lid falling off. But still, I mean, I don't know how they calculate the amount of money that's paid out. If she did suffer scars, is there some part of her body that's not functional anymore? I mean, maybe that would justify such a huge amount of cash.
Yeah, it's interesting. I imagine if you're working at the window, they probably have told them, you make sure that lid's on there good and tight, you know. And even if it is on there and you grab it and you squeeze it, yeah, it pops off. So I'm waiting for somebody to sue because the ice drink was too cold and they, you know, like gave them brain freeze or something. It's always the hot beverages. What about a cold beverage getting in here and causing some mischief?
Yeah, it's there's lots of things that can go wrong with, I can think of a dozen cases where I went to a restaurant and something bad happened, and it wasn't anyone's fault. It just happened, I guess. Maybe the knife was too sharp and it cut through the plate or something ridiculous like that, but not a glass plate.
I was going to say, that was one sharp knife.
But, I mean, this case, like Grant mentioned, there's a little more validity to her getting some compensation. I think the dollar amount's a little ridiculous, but Starbucks didn't make a mistake, or that employee did. So it's probably better that the company took it, or else she would sue that guy whoever's in the window. So the company probably bailed out that individual. But
I think they can afford the $100,000. Yeah. I don't think that'll hurt their bottom line. That was a great play on words there, by the way, too. It was validity. That was great. The lid on the coffee. It's tremendous. Yeah,
I've been around my wife too much, so she loves puns. And
oh, yeah.
Now they're starting to occur naturally.
That's what the title should have been of the article is, you know, valid case.
Valid.
Valid. It was valid. Yeah, so anyway, that occurred. The worst thing that's ever happened to me at a restaurant outside of two food poisoning situations, which were bad, was I had a frozen margarita one time. And I had you get brain freeze sometimes. It was
one
the
sip.
Worst yeah. I actually had to leave. We were kind of done with the meal anyway, but I'm like, I have to leave. Your head starts to hurt, of course, and then it started to hurt in my chest. And, I thought, okay, I'm probably okay, but in the back of my mind, I'm like, am I dying? Like, it was really painful. I don't think you could sue for that, but... Yeah. Too cold. It was too cold.
Yeah, some of those frozen drinks, you could just take a sip and then... It just keeps spreading. It's like a delayed effect.
Yeah.
Like 20 seconds after you took the sip, it starts to set in, and then it just starts to spread through your whole body. And it's almost like there's some sort of a chemical in there, like liquid nitrogen or something, the fact that it can get that extreme.
Yeah, because as soon as I noticed it, I stopped. But it was too late. And like you say, it's like this creeping thing. But usually it gets to a certain point, and then it stops. But this, it just kept going. And so I was out in the, like, my eyes were watering, and I was trying to, it was a tough deal, but I survived it. That happened on an airplane one time, not with the drink, but just the pressure build up in your head, and usually it gets to a point, and then it kind of relieves, but it kept building and building. I had the same thought. I'm like, is my head going to explode? Will I die on this plane? Is that possible?
I feel like that's the biggest reason why babies cry on planes so much is because they're, like, they get that pressure in their ears, and they obviously don't know how to fix that. Hopefully the parents do. That's
right.
About it though.
Well, if they're younger, it's good. They usually have them have a candy or something to suck on, or if they're really, really young, sometimes you can nurse them on takeoff. I think they let you do that if I remember correctly, because it relieves some of that that pressure. Don't want a screaming baby or a screaming adult either. the Trumpet Daily program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. You can hear some of the graduation announcements, commencement address from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury from yesterday from Armstrong College. We're at the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College. That's on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today. Really great message there, so make sure you listen for that. Also, thetrumpet.com, today's top stories, Sebastian Kurz, A Strong Man Rises in Austria. And related to that, how Europe is, quote-unquote, winning against the far right and democracy is dying. Those are the top stories at thetrumpet.com. Did you guys know that America's cities are running out of room? More people want to move downtown, apparently, but only the rich can do it. And they're running out of houses. That's what they claim. I see people building everywhere. Who are these people, and why are they building houses?
Yeah, that's really not too surprising if you're just talking about the downtown area, because I've walked downtown for quite a few times, like in Seattle or Oklahoma City, and there's a couple apartment buildings, but the fact that, you know, maybe around 1 million people might work in the city, depending on how big the city is, and you can only find a couple apartments after a really long walk, it might seem that downtown housing is a bit too rare.
This is from Bloomberg. They say everyone wants to live downtown, but only the rich can afford it. It's getting worse, they say. A shortage of homes for sale has bedeviled U.S. house hunters in recent years. What do you mean a shortage of houses? They're everywhere. They say, so why don't builders build more? One problem is that they're running out of lots to build on, at least in the places that people want to live. Like you said, Grant, they want to live downtown. They're running out of lots and places to build. Cities that were sprawling before the Great Recession have begun to sprawl again. Space-constrained cities, meanwhile, have run out of room to build. That reality has spurred developers to focus on center city neighborhoods where high-density building is allowed and new units command exceedingly high prices. If you've seen some of the prices for downtown places, even here in Oklahoma City, it is mind-boggling for what they would want to charge you. And then if you get to a bigger city, forget about it.
So they're talking about building actual houses downtown. I never even knew that was a thing. It doesn't seem like there would be any room for that. That's not really surprising at all.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're just talking about houses or just housing in general.
Oh, okay.
But they are looking for lots to build on. One thing that they've done well, I think, here locally in Oklahoma City is they've gone to areas where there were run-down buildings and they've rehabbed them or put something up that's new. And you're seeing that in some cities where they're doing that. And old areas that were kind of dying are now thriving a little bit. So I think that's a good idea. But the thing about that is when it becomes an area you might want to go to, then people want to live closer to it, and then the prices go up. I mean, there are places even down Oklahoma City I've seen, like an apartment. You know, it's a nice apartment or a nice condo or something, but it's like $1 million.
Yeah.
Like, huh? Yeah, you know, you could just move out of town a few miles and save yourself some money.
Yeah, it seems like the infrastructure in North America, I think in general, because it was built a long time ago, it's old, or society has changed so much where some of the buildings aren't that necessary anymore, or they're not placed where people want them to be. And so I think it's causing a problem where people are wanting to be more urbanized in these downtown areas, but the kind of society that there was in the 70s and the 50s when most of these cities were built was much different. And people liked still living in the country and in suburbs away. So I saw that in Calgary. I lived there. Then we went back a few times in the past, I think, 10 years since I moved or something like that. And it's the city's completely changed, and it's just exploded on the outskirts of all these new homes, but the downtown is still essentially the same. But more people will move there. There's more jobs in the downtown, but people have to live farther away because there's no space. And the apartments are downtown. They're for handicapped or retired people. They're not for there's some places that are for like the rich oil barons, but but it's a lot different than how we want it to be.
Yeah, they constantly are building here. I mean, again, it's a lot of it's moving out of the city. The city's sprawling, and that's what's kind of interesting about buying a house in town. You don't know what the neighborhood's gonna be. You know, like in 10 years, in 15 years, it might be better, or it might be like, oh, nobody wants to live over there anymore. So that's always kind of the hard thing. You go as the neighborhood goes, right? So that's apparently an issue. But I always just tend to think, well, isn't the housing market going to kind of burst again? Like, it seems like we're reinflating the bubble.
Right.
I mean, like, who has these jobs where you can afford these $500,000 houses every couple of blocks, new ones and new ones? I don't know who those people are.
Yeah, it seems like that would be a rare individual who could fill those housing needs, I guess. But it's kind of understandable why you'd want to live in a place like downtown Oklahoma City, where it's not too big. There's actual parking lots where you can actually find parking there. But some cities, they're so big that, I mean, you would be paying a fortune, several hundred dollars a month just for parking, probably, or you'd have to take public transportation, which a lot of the time is unsafe. So, yeah, why not just live outside the city? It's a little bit safer, a little bit more space. You can actually afford it a little bit easier.
You know, a really odd town, and it's not a big town, but is Green Bay, Wisconsin, because you've got the Packers there and you've got Lambeau Field, but it's like 100,000 people. And so it's really a small town, and then you've got this Lambeau Field right in the middle and a huge NFL thing. And so the people that live close by, I mean, it's like normal neighborhood. Oh, and there's Lambeau Field. And, you know, they can make okay money because they sell parking on their lawns. You got to park somewhere, so you park on their lawn. So I should have invested in parking lots.
Yeah.
You know, if you could own a parking lot near a nice venue, just pay some people to man it and just watch the money roll in. I always think about that when Thunder games come around. Like, who owns this parking lot? It's, you know, $20 a head, $10 a head to park in here. You got 100 cars in there. It's good if you can do it.
Yeah, I'm sure they have to pay a lot to keep the parking lot, just pay the city a lot. But yeah, it would more than pay off, if especially if there are a lot of events in that area. That's the one time where Oklahoma City does need more parking whenever those Thunder games. You can't really avoid paying a good amount to park.
Yeah, unless you want to walk a long way.
Right.
But there's actually, it's interesting right up here, there's some new colors apparently being created by algorithms. And they're not, I mean, they're new, but they're a combination, obviously, of colors we're familiar with, including Hunt Club Red, Plunge Pool, Stanky Bean, Gray Pock, and Burf Pink. They say these aren't the those are some of the names. They say these aren't the names of underground punk bands, but they should be. I added that they should be. They're unique new colors you might soon see on kitchen walls. The first two were created by designers at PPG, a leading industrial chemical firm and Fortune 500 company. The others were generated by a neutral algorithm trained by Janelle Shane for Sherwin Williams. And so they're coming up with new colors you might put in your house.
Yeah, I think, was it Burf Pink and Stanky Bean? I don't think those two will be popular. I don't even know what they look like. But
Gray Pock or something?
Yeah.
They all sound horrendous, really.
They
but
do.
Maybe they look better than they sound.
And just, even if it was a nice color, you wouldn't want somebody to come to your house and say, I love what you've done with the place. What color is that on the wall? And you say, well, thanks for asking. That's Stanky Bean. Nobody wants to say that.
What general color is that?
I'm not sure. I don't
that
know.
It doesn't really give away a lot in the name there.
It doesn't. But you can go to this story at NBCnews.com, new colors created by algorithms, and they'll give you the numbers. You know, they have the three numbers that you can punch into like Photoshop, and it'll give you the colors. So they've got a list there. So if you want to take a look at it, you can do that. It's a combination of obviously colors we're familiar with, but they're having these algorithms just kind of punch out some numbers and see what you come up with. And I guess it, you know, in a way, it they could make more money maybe, because you're trying to sell paint for people in their houses, I guess, would be the main thing, maybe other things. And people always kind of want the new, cool color, whatever it might be. You can always tell when you look at the interior of a home when it was built. Because you're like, oh, that looks like 1980s, you know, the colors and things like that. So anyway, if you want to be on cutting edge, the cutting edge, go get yourself a can of Stanky Bean.
Yeah, it's I think most of the times they make these new colors. I can't even tell the difference between that and 50 other shades of whatever. Maybe that's a bad number.
Women can. That's the thing.
50 shades is a bad phrase to use, actually. But there's anyway, there's just so many different shades of colors that it's I just can't tell the difference. And I just going shop or being with my wife while she's helping women pick out like their colors for weddings and stuff. She's like, we need this color tie. I'm like, well, that's blue. She's like, no, we need like turquoise, crystal, Cinderella blue. I'm like, well, there's two different colored blues. You have to choose one. Like, some people are just so specific, and I don't see a big difference between them. But that's just my perspective.
Yeah, you definitely wouldn't want to go with a burf pink for the wedding colors. Probably. But anyway, they've got some interesting colors. You can take a look at them, NBCNews.com. New colors created by algorithms. Check it out if you're interested. Grant, you've got a write-up for us here. This is about probably the biggest news, I guess, going on right now as far as the U.S. is concerned, and that is President Trump's trip to the Middle East. This write-up is from the American Spectator. So why didn't any of the Sunni leaders smile during the president's speech? That's their question.
And that's the hard question that needs to be answered, because I read the whole transcript of the speech. It's like 6 or 7 pages long, and it really was, a presidential speech. It did come across as dignified and hopeful, and it seemed like he was focused on solutions instead of always just pointing out the problems. He did say that a big problem is radical Islamic extremism or terrorism. But the thing was, it seemed to make all of the other leaders in the Middle East angry, the ones listening in the audience there. It's strange that terrorism has plagued those nations more than any other. 95% of terrorist victims are people in the Middle East, yet didn't seem like the leaders there were too excited to go on the attack against that problem.
Yeah, there seems to have been, agreement when it comes to money and certain trade deals. But then when you start talking ideologies, we have some different viewpoints, it looks like.
Right. Mr. Trump did go there and make about $500 billion worth of deals with Saudi Arabia, and he did praise those countries for being really some of the crossroads of civilization, some of the earliest foundational areas where civilization developed. But people just didn't really seem to appreciate the praise. There wasn't hardly any clapping throughout the speech. There was even a point in the speech where he paused after an obvious applause line that he gave, and there was just complete silence. If you contrast that to Mr. Obama's Cairo speech in 2009, where he didn't mention terrorism a single time, compared to Mr. Trump's 31 times in this speech, they were standing and applauding throughout the speech.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because if you're just going to use the response to a speech as a barometer, you know, I think that could be misleading, because they may have applauded. And Abraham's going to talk about some of that history of President Obama's speech as well, so that'll be a good tie-in. But, people can applaud, but at the same time, we have not been respected by those countries. As was brought out, I think it was on Watch Jerusalem today, they played a clip of President Trump before he was president talking about the reception that President Obama got when he went back to, I think it was Saudi Arabia, years later. No one even met him. No one of importance. So they can applaud at your speech, but they don't respect you.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe they didn't like the speech, but maybe they'll respect it a little more.
Hopefully, because if you remember, Mr. Obama actually did bow to the King of Saudi Arabia, actually. So Mr. Trump did not do that when he had the opportunity to do the same thing. He did not put on any headgear, and perhaps more importantly, his own wife and daughter did not wear any of the traditional Arab headdress for the females. So maybe they didn't appreciate that too much, but he didn't come in there trying to tell anyone what to do. Repeatedly in the speech, he was talking about how America is not trying to enforce its doctrine, its beliefs on everyone else. We come here, we are hoping for peace, but we do have to acknowledge that terrorism is a problem and work to basically to conquer it, to wipe it off the face of the earth, he said. So that was a really encouraging message. It even gave me chills just reading about it in the transcript. I didn't even get to hear it live or anything. But that's something that really anyone with a sound mind should be able to agree with, getting rid of these massacres that have taken place all over the world.
Yeah, well, I wonder, these different leaders, you know, like who they are, they're worried about in terms of their response. I mean, maybe personally they agree with it, but maybe they can't show that. I mean, here in the U.S., it's so divided that even when something is said in a, you know, that is good and that everybody would agree with, if it's said from the other side of the aisle, typically the opponents, we don't agree with that, because they're trying to keep the party line. And I wonder if it's similar here with some of these Sunni leaders.
Well, I think it's a lot of political posturing, and it's also a cultural difference, where with all the unrest at home, I don't think these leaders want to show that they love Trump, because it could alienate them from other countries who don't like President Trump. So I think there's some posturing there, but also the setting is much different. It's not necessarily one like where President Obama was at Cairo University, where it's a smaller room. There's more secular people there, and they're used to clapping. This group of leaders is very different. And even at the UN, you don't have widespread applause as much as you do in other settings. Right. And this was more of that kind of place. So I think it's a combination, but it's also a cultural thing where, based off of my reading and what experts say, is that Arab leaders, they can be very suspicious of American, especially ones that they're not unfamiliar with, American leaders, because you need to prove yourself before they respect you, and before they trust you, and before they'll give you adulation. And so I think with President Trump, it's his first foray into that area as the president. And time will tell if those bonds grow stronger between those nations and peoples. But I didn't expect them to be all over him, because he has to prove himself. And then, as with any Western leader in the Arab world, once you prove yourself, they're very loyal to you, and they'll support you. But you have to prove yourself first.
Yeah, and what did the last 8 years show? That America was pretty wishy-washy during that time period, betraying allies, bolstering enemies. So I could see why they'd be a little leery.
Yeah, hopefully that's not something that they were approving of. I mean, maybe they liked his speech 8 years ago, but a lot of the actions did not seem to do anyone really too many favors, except for Iran, which is a grave enemy of most of the leaders at this conference here. So they probably were not a big fan of the Obama administration treating Iran as well as they did. But speaking of the UN, Saudi Arabia actually recently tried to strike down a resolution naming the ISIS branch in Saudi Arabia as a terrorist organization, even though it's a part of ISIS. It's within their country, but they don't even want to acknowledge that they have a terrorist problem there. It's similar to what we see in the West, where we don't even like to acknowledge that terrorism is an issue. If you can't even point out who the enemy is, it's a little bit difficult to destroy the enemy.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Abe, we can just jump into your segment here too and have a little discussion about that, because it ties right in. And you were going to talk about this speech as well and compare it somewhat to the speech that was made by President Obama in Cairo 8 years ago. Both foreign policy speeches were meant to set the tone for the new administrations. So we're going to compare and contrast those.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. I did some basic, I analyzed the words that were used and then the content, and I just have a few different stats here and point out some of the major differences. What I think interesting is just the length of each speech. The Riyadh speech made by President Trump, the word count was about 3,400. President Obama's Cairo speech was 5,800. So President Trump's speech was only about 60% of what President Obama's was. So it was the Cairo speech is almost twice as long. And I'll get to why here in a second. And that is the messages. Each speech had pretty fundamentally the same message from American foreign policy. There's always a continuation of the foreign policy from administration to administration. But they went about it in very different ways. From what I read both transcripts and analyzed them. And the first, President Trump's speech, he had one clear message in the speech. That is to restore the partnerships between the Saudi Arabia and those nations with the United States and to end terrorism. That was the one fundamental message throughout the whole speech. You can, from start to finish. So it's much more simpler message. President Obama's speech, he had seven different parts of it. The first was reconciliation between Islam and America. Then he went on seven different topics. He talked about violent extremism. The second one, Israel and Palestine. Third, nuclear weapons. Who should have them? Who shouldn't? Fourth, democracy in the Middle East. Fifth, religious freedom. Sixth, religious or women's rights. Seven, economic development and opportunity. So President Obama's speech was a very winding speech of about a bunch of different topics. President Trump's was much more forceful and to the point about ending terrorism. And I think what's interesting, I did some word analysis. President Trump mentions God nine different times. And he mentions God in a very specific way. He's not referring to the God of all people. He's referring to his God that he worships in the context of his phrases. President Obama mentions God seven times, but they're all very general. And you can tell it just in the context of each sentence. And then President Obama mentions the Quran four times. He quotes it three times. And President Trump doesn't mention anything like that at all in his speech. So President Trump's has a much more Christian overtones to it than President Obama's. But I think the biggest difference of all is how both countries approach Iran. I think that's the biggest difference. And President Obama, he dedicated about 130 words criticizing Iran, but he dedicated about 235 words to criticizing Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So double on Israel than on Iran. And then with President Trump, he didn't criticize Israel or the Palestinians. He only mentions them very briefly near the end. And then President Trump spends 272 words on Iran. And he's much more forceful in his language. He says they're the source of terrorism in the Middle East. They have to stop. We should sanction them. And he accuses them of causing the violence in Syria, funding different terrorist groups. He's much more forceful and specific. Doesn't mention nuclear weapons at all. And President Obama said that, well, they kidnapped Americans. They killed some in terrorist attacks. But there's been a dialogue of mistrust on both sides. And basically, he was apologizing.
Yep.
And that's another big difference is throughout President Obama's speech, he apologized several times. He apologized for British colonialism and American Cold War policies alienating Muslims from the West. He compared the Palestinians to black slavery in America and how the Palestinians can use the same methods as Martin Luther King Jr. The civil rights movement to gain their state from Israel. And he apologized several times just for American Islamophobia and that all that sort of thing. And so that was a major part of his speech. And whenever he talked about religion in America, he only talked about Islam. He didn't talk about Christians in America. President Trump was very different. No apology at all. He said his big part of his speech was says, you Arab nations, it's your job to end terrorism. American power can't do it by itself. It's your job. And if more people die from terrorism, it's your fault. It's not my fault. So he much more forceful, much more direct. That's probably why those leaders didn't like it. Because
you're not going to jump up and be like, yes, I concur.
was basically telling them, you have to actually want to stop terrorism, because it did seem like they were not too concerned with that at all.
Well, that's absolutely right, because they could if they wanted to, you know, or at least make an effort at it. And so I think one thing we've seen with President Trump, and even before he was president, what he is good at is really kind of getting to the source of problems. People responded to that on the campaign trail, and I think people that aren't just blinded by, you know, some radical thinking would appreciate what he said in that speech, because he did get to the root of some problems.
Yeah, and I just want to read a couple. The big thing, I just want to contrast what they said about Iran, because I think it's probably the most interesting part of it. This is what President Trump said about Iran, and I'll just hit the high spots. He said, but no discussion of stamping out this threat, terrorism, would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three, safe harbor, financial backing, and social standing needed for recruitment. It is the regime that is responsible for so much instability in the region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran. From Lebanon to Iraq to Yemen, Iran funds, arms, and trains terrorists, militias, and other extremist groups. that spread destruction and chaos across the region. For decades, Iran has fueled the fires of sectarian conflict and terror. It is the government that speaks openly of mass murder, vowing the destruction of Israel, death to America, and ruin for many leaders and nations in this room. And then he goes on more specifically about how they've been helping President Assad in Syria kill innocent people. So, I mean, that's probably the strongest message any American president has ever said about Iran, I would say. So a very, very strong message. And then I have President Obama, what he said about Iran. And this is done in the context of nuclear weapons, this statement here. This is what President Obama said about Iran 8 years ago. This issue has been a source of tension between the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran, talking about nuclear weapons. For many years, Iran has defined itself in part by its opposition to my country, and there is indeed a tumultuous history between us. Then he talks about the Islamic Revolution, and he says, this history is well known. Rather than remain trapped in the past, I have made it clear to Iran's leaders and people that my country is prepared to move forward. The question now is not what Iran is against, but rather what the future it wants to build. It will be a hard to overcome decades of mistrust, but we will proceed with courage, rectitude, and resolve. So that's essentially what the only criticism President Obama said of Iran during his speech. Huge, vastly different approaches to it. I think a lot of Sunnis do appreciate how strongly President Trump came against the Shiite regime there.
Yeah, there's a great write-up that you need to look at thetrumpet.com, How President Obama's Cairo Speech Will Shake the Nations, by Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, written back when that occurred in 2009. And so go back and read that article at thetrumpet.com. But it is very interesting to see the difference there between the two speeches. And I can't help but think that the speech that President Obama gave, it reminds me of somebody coming out of, say, a university where you're kind of surrounded by the same sort of like-minded people and you all have your big causes and your big thinking about things. But it doesn't translate to the real world. And you go out there and you lay out this, you know, speech like he did. And it might play well in a university class. It doesn't play well in the real world because it's fantasy. And all this apologizing and civil rights. They don't care about civil rights. What do you know about the history of the Middle East? Is that their number one concern? Come on. It doesn't play well in the real world.
Just look at the way Mr. Trump proposed putting Iran in check. He proposed taking things away, isolating them from the rest of the world, imposing sanctions on them, really just punishing them, as opposed to Mr. Obama proposing giving things to them, making concessions, talking, hopefully making peace that way. Which ideology is more grounded in the real world?
Yeah, absolutely. And that you see that happen too. I mean, across the board, sometimes people will come out of a schooling situation and then they have to meet the reality of the world. You know, okay, that's how they taught you to do the job. Okay, now I'm doing the job. It's a little different. And so it seems the same with those speeches, where one was a scholarly sort of fantasy that, again, it would play well at a university, Cairo University. I'm sure they'd love it. But the leaders know that's not the way things work.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that both leaders went through a broad sweep of history in the region, praising each country. But President Obama went through Islamic history. He went through the history of the religion and praising how it's tolerant and all that. President Trump, he praised each nation, but on a nationalist level. He didn't talk about them as an Islamic people. He talked about them individually in their history. And I think that's a big difference. President Trump wasn't praising Islam. He was praising the nation state. And that's a big departure from President Obama's message. But I quickly wrote on the list, what happened after President Obama's Cairo speech? Because we're all thinking, well, what's going to happen after the Riyadh speech? And after this message where President Obama apologized, he said, well, Islam is tolerant. We have a big future together. What happens in 8 years? And these are just the four things that I thought of off the top of my head. The Arab Spring, the removal of Hosni Mubarak and Gaddafi, The second one, ISIS conquers Iraq and Syria and becomes any of all these different terrorist threats around the world. The Syrian civil war, which has left 500,000 people dead, several million displaced, as we've already talked about. And then the fourth big one, the Iranian nuclear deal, where you've had American sailors held hostage, ransom money paid, and this deal with America. So all these things happened after President Obama's speech, where he had a lot of high hopes, but things have gotten progressively much worse. And so with President Trump's speech, much is still to be seen what will happen, but based off of this, it'll probably get worse, possibly, because it seems like, unless something drastically changes, that's the direction the region's heading.
Yeah, and some fairly strong words, I guess, from President Trump. But if there's not action to back it up, it doesn't mean anything. Like, are we going to intervene? Because it is true to a point, like he said, that they have to want to stop terrorism. But the U.S. has the power to stop the source of it if they want to.
Yeah.
So is that going to happen?
Well, I did see a story. Secretary of Defense Mattis, James Mattis, he did announce on Friday that they have a plan to annihilate ISIS, and does involve U.S. ground troops in Syria. And they use very strong language. He said President Trump told him to make a plan to annihilate ISIS.
Right.
So they're using language they should have been using for years, dealing with this terrorist group. More Marines are going to Afghanistan, and more advisors went to Iraq. So it's a very small buildup. It's nothing major. It's probably the only thing President Trump can do in the current political climate, send small amounts of sailors and troops abroad. But we haven't seen a counterpart in the Arab world. Maybe the only counterpart would be Saudi Arabia fighting the Houthis in that region. But otherwise, we haven't seen the Sunnis make these big armies and go destroy these terrorist groups. And in fact, Iran's funding the militias fighting ISIS in Iraq so that they essentially conquer Iraq by liberating them from ISIS.
Yeah. It's interesting to see what'll happen after this. But President Trump is there in Israel today. He's visiting the Western Wall. I believe they said he was the first sitting president to do that, if I read that correctly. So it'd be interesting to see what's said. And, the big thing is, can they bring peace to the Middle East? They've been talking about that for years and years and years. I will say no. I will go out on a limb and say they will not be successful, but they will try.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that the president actually went to that wall there. I've been there. It was 9 years ago, but there are a lot of areas looking down on the wall, and it's just kind of in the middle of the old city there. So it's almost like they would have had to have locked down the old city to even make that trip possible for him.
Yeah, you really have to have quite a security detail, you know, because any major leader obviously is sort of a targeted individual, but particularly heading over to a volatile area like that. So it'll be interesting to see what's ahead in the next few days with that. And, of course, there's some great information on Watch Jerusalem that you can hear here, where Brett Noctegal talks about that trip a little bit. And, of course, Trumpet Daily Radio Show has a lot about that, and thetrumpet.com. One last note before we close today. Grant, you're having a baby pretty soon.
Yes.
It's not a secret.
I don't think so.
I think people know. here are some of the top baby names for the ladies. Adeline, Charlotte, and Riley. The top three baby names. They're on the rise. More people are using those names. You want to take one of those?
Actually, I know two people in the church who have named their girls, those last two, Charlotte and Riley. So mm-hmm. Maybe I shouldn't take those two.
How does this happen? How do people know that it's... Do people name their kids that because it's popular, or is it just organic? I always wonder.
I think it depends on the person. I know some people research it really thoroughly because they don't want their child to have a weird name.
Yeah.
Like that makes them feel uncomfortable. Some parents do that on purpose because they want to humble their child, I guess, as they grow up. But I think most of the time it's organic. Because for whatever reason, they heard the name in passing and it's kind of bouncing around in their head.
For the boys' top three names, this is surprising to me. Number one is Mateo.
Yeah.
I don't know that I know anybody named that. Oliver, oldie but a goodie, is making a return, and Bryson. Those are the top three boy baby names at this time. So you can let those percolate, roll around in your head a little bit. A lot of times what it comes down to, I found this when I was naming my children, my wife and I, is that there would be a name one of us would come up with, and we'd be like, yeah, I like that name, but I can't because I knew a kid in school, and it just drove me crazy, and that was his name. Or that's the name of our neighbor's dog. Or, you know, there's something that you can't do it just because of that. So that factors in, too.
That's the difficult part, too, because everyone who interacts with your child will also have those sort of connections with the name, or at least some people will, and either favorable or unfavorable, you can't possibly know how people are going to react to it.
Yeah, there's when the time is right, and we'll let you reveal the whatever the name will be to us. You, Abraham, you're not quite there yet, but as far as I know, but you got some names you're kicking around.
We were, but someone took the name we had in mind.
That happens. That happens too. Yeah, your friends take the name.
Yeah. So, but that's fine. There's plenty of other names out there. But the problem I have is I want my son or daughter be named after like a family name, someone in the family, or a famous historical person.
Yep.
Like a general or a president or something like that, or a Canadian hockey player. So I kept throwing these names at my wife. She's like, "No, I knew a guy in high school. He's really weird." Yeah. But I'm like, "But you wouldn't know him, but no one else.
We were classmates.
No,
we were named after me."
No.
But Gordy Howe.
Yeah, exactly.
Gordy and Jordy.
There you go.
Yeah, Gretzky Blondo.
There you go.
But just all these different names, and she's like, "No, I don't like that." Like I went through every famous person I could think of, and they all struck down.
Let's do this, Abraham, since you always like to do your Twitter polls. Do a new Twitter poll for people to write in and say what they think Grant should name his kid.
I'll do that.
Do it today. We'll have the results here in a few days. I'm sure the listeners would be excited to do that and throw out some ideas. That's all the time we have for today. On Trumpet Radio Live, we will have results of that poll. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo, have a tremendous rest of the Monday. And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.